The House Human Service Finance and Policy Committee will be called to order. We do have a quorum, and Representative Vernick moves approval of the meeting minutes from March 18th, 2025. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes?
No.
Senator Vernick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I move that minutes from March 13th, please.
All right, and seeing no other feedback, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes from March 18th, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The minutes are approved. The motion is approved, and the minutes from March 18, 2025 are adopted. First on the agenda for today, Representative Rapinski, and I will move that House File 1358 is to be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Representative Rapinski, welcome to the committee. Whenever you're ready, please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher and Knorr and members. I do want to start with the tradition of the first time a freshman presents a bill in a committee brings treats. So I, along with my fellow cohort, Hilda, I do have some treats, and there's a variety of treats here, so I'm going to pass these around. Feel free to take as many as you like.
Mr. Chair, you know, we...
Representative Knorr.
I think we abandoned that tradition long time ago.
Seems to be that we're benefiting from it today, though, Representative. Representative Rapinski.
Chairs and my fellow members, today I have the honor of presenting House File 1358. Simple yet impactful legislation that would provide sustainable funding for critical services provided in Winona, Minnesota. Hiawatha Valley Mental Health Center is a nonprofit provider that seeks to provide exceptional mental and behavioral support and services to enhance the well-being of the region. An essential service Hiawatha Valley provides is housing with support. As I'm sure this committee knows, stable housing is critical to recovery for both mental health and substance abuse disorders. This bill will allow county agencies to negotiate a supplementary services rate for up to 53 beds across multiple settings in Winona County. Hiawatha Valley's regional housing program settings serve individuals outside of Winona County as well, including residents from Wabasha, Goodhue, Fillmore, Houston, Steele, Dodge, Waseca, Maurer, and Olmsted counties. The good work of Hiawatha Valley is wide-reaching and essential to the region, and they are the only provider in the area with this level of housing with support services. The increased funding would go towards staff recruitment and retention efforts through wage increases, amongst other things. I would like to draw your attention to the one pager that describes the services offered in these settings, as well as the letters of support from Winona, Wabasha, and Houston counties. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers that can describe this in more detail.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Schumacher, Knorr, and members, my name is Eric Sievers. I'm the Executive Director of Hiawatha Valley Mental Health Center. We are a comprehensive community mental health center providing services in five rural counties, those being Winona, Fillmore, Wabasha, Houston, and Goodhue County. I'm here to testify to support House File 1358. As we know, mental health conditions can often create challenges in daily life for some, including employment, paying for rent, utilities, and maintaining housing. Symptoms such as illogical, disorganized thinking, isolation, and stigma can make it difficult for someone to seek help. Having a stable home environment has been widely recognized as critical to recovery for both mental health and substance use disorders. This bill supports both those things. It supports both mental health and housing. Since the 80s, for over 40 years now, Hiawatha Valley Mental Health Center has been the regional leader in providing long-term housing and support. Today, we're the only provider, as Representative Rapinski mentioned, in the area that provides the amount of housing that we provide to support those with mental health conditions. We offer this through four houses and a 20 single bedroom facility. As the one pager mentions, we offer in the area these services, including supplemental rate services such as overnight 24-hour supervision, medication reminders, assistant with transportation, arranging for meetings and appointments, and arranging for medical services. This is a very challenging service to provide. We do this because our mission requires it of us. Others do not do this because there are a lot of challenges, including staffing, funding, and some of the individuals we serve and help really need a higher level of care that is just not available in our area. The impact this programming has is it's been shown to help the journey of recovery, prevent hospitalizations, homelessness, and involvement with the criminal justice system. Last year alone, we served over 87 individuals through this programming, and over the years, we have impacted positively over 100 lives. In 2024, funding supported over 21,000 services through this supplemental service. Currently, we have individuals who have stayed in our homes for up to 26 years. In our Hiawatha Bluff apartment living facility, we have individuals who have been there for over 8 years. The investment to support this funding will reduce and has been shown to reduce emergency room visits, hospitalizations, and overall public spending, making it a cost-effective long-term solution. Thank you, Representative Rapinski, for your work on this bill, and thank you for letting me testify today and for your support for House File 1358.
Thank you, Mr. Sievers, for your testimony. And Nicole Latham on Zoom.
Hi. My name is Nicole Latham, and I've been living at Hiawatha Bluff Living Residential Program for about 2 years. Before coming here, I experienced homelessness, moving in and out of boarding lodges, facilities, and two intensive residential programs, and I also had a suicide attempt. My mental health and substance use challenges in the past significantly impacted my ability to maintain stable housing, secure employment, and build positive relationships with my family and others. At HBL, the medication support helps me stay on track with my medication regimen, and having staff available around the clock allows me to connect with someone whenever I need support. I was able to get my driver's license back, and the staff here played a significant role in the process. They assist in finding resources and guide me through the necessary steps to achieve my goals. My emotions are much more in check now, and I feel on a better wavelength, but I still have my tough days. On those days, having someone to connect with helps me get through. The funding for this program has made a huge difference in my ability to heal and regain control of my life. Without it, I'm not sure of how things would have progressed. Over the past 3 years, I've participated in case management, ARMS, substance abuse programs, dialectical behavior therapy, psychiatry. These programs provided me with stability and the tools to maintain a balanced life. I've been sober for over 3 years now, reconnected with my family, been employed for roughly a year, and I've never missed a day of work, and have the tools to manage my emotions now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Latham, for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes from the public to testify on House File 1358? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Questions from members for the testifiers or for Representative Rapinski? Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rapinski, thank you for a wonderful presentation and for the snack.
Thank you, Representative Gander. Any other questions or comments for the testifiers or bill author? Seeing none, final word, Representative Rapinski.
Thank you, members. Thank you, chairs. I appreciate the time and the opportunity to present this wonderful bill, and I would appreciate your support. Thank you very much.
With that, House File 1358 is laid over. Next, House File 1973, Representative Perryman. And as Representative Perryman makes her way to the testifier table, I will move that House File 1973 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Representative Perryman, welcome to the committee. As you get settled in, please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. House File 1973, I'm very happy you're hearing it today. It is a bill that is not only important to me as a representative from the St. Cloud area, but is equally as important to the 14 counties it represents in central Minnesota that would be positively impacted by the bill. Chair and members, we are all acutely aware that public funds invested in the HHS budget are scarce, and we should understand that the future holds a lot of uncertainties around the availability of both federal and state funds. With this bill, we have an opportunity to look at smarter ways to stretch public dollars. Again, opportunity to look at smarter ways to stretch public dollars. The bill appropriates $420,000 each year in the next biennium, But the reason for this is much broader than just filling the gap for providing senior population nutritional meals. The bill could allow us to look at how we can better spend limited dollars while still achieving the critical goals of providing meals to seniors. And thinking outside of the box is crucial in this space right now. So our goal of this bill is to pilot new methods to approach this very scarce funding that we have in senior nutritional meals, approach a method, and then come back and report the success that I know this group will have with these dollars to help senior citizen nutritional meals. I would like to turn it over to now to one of my testifiers, and they can introduce themselves, and they will let you know the meat and bones, no pun intended, around this bill.
Thank you for the pun, Representative Perryman. I always appreciate that. Whomever would like to go first, please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher and the entire Human Services Committee. My name is Aaron Fisk. I'm the President and CEO of Catholic Charities of the Diocese of St. Cloud. We are the largest social services nonprofit in the central Minnesota area. We have three main pillars. We have mental health, we have housing, and today we're going to be talking about senior dining within our food access area. As Representative Perryman talked about, we serve 14 counties in three main delivery methods currently for senior dining. The first is congregate dining, where people dine together. The second is Meals on Wheels for those who are homebound. And the third is frozen meal distribution, which really came out of COVID when you couldn't do congregate meals together. In 2024, we served over 350,000 meals to over 5,200 individuals throughout our service area. And one of the things I came from in this role from a previous experience of 20 years in for-profit, and one of the things that I noticed is the current trajectory isn't going to be sustainable for this program when I took a look. And so I'm now going to turn it over to Stacey Lund, our Director of Community Services, to kind of talk about where we are now and where we want to go from here. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Fisk. Ms. Lund, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Oh, thank you, Chair Schumacher. My name is Stacey Lund, and like Aaron mentioned, I am the Director of Community Services at Catholic Charities in St. Cloud, and I oversee our senior dining or senior nutrition program that we provide in 14 counties in central Minnesota. In my role, we are a recipient in St. Cloud at Catholic Charities of Title III dollars, which come from the state and are federal dollars that come to the state through the Minnesota Board on Aging. And we have been a partner with them and a provider in central Minnesota for 50 years with senior nutrition. And we are at a state right now where we understand that, you know, funding will continue to decrease at the federal and state level. And as a provider, we really are looking to be more strategic and have some flexibility to develop some partnerships and look at different ways of providing services, particularly in our rural communities where resources are more and more scarce, but the needs continue to increase. And that has been proven to us during COVID time when we developed our frozen meal distributions, that a different model outside of the traditional congregate or home-delivered meal that comes to seniors through Meals on Wheels is welcomed by seniors in the communities and is also a need. And as we go through this transition of the sunsetting of COVID dollars that were there to support some of those operations, it's becoming very clear to us that we need to come up with different solutions to serve our populations as we move forward. And our traditional Title III dollars, of course, continue to decrease, and your budgets and your decisions become more difficult to make. Outside of the Title III dollars, it's difficult to manage the regulations that come with those Title III dollars and to establish some flexibility and creativity in becoming more strategic with some of those rural communities to figure out plans and resources that work for those communities. It's not going to be the same for us in Hinckley as it maybe would be in Albany, Minnesota. So we really are looking for some flexibility with these particular dollars to come up with some partnerships with local schools, local business partnerships, and some different avenues of ways to feed folks and to get meals to seniors who really are interested in remaining in their homes, remaining independent, but need senior nutrition. In the whole landscape of keeping our seniors healthy, nutrition is a foundational piece of that equation. And without that, those seniors will not be able to maintain their independence as long as we want them to. Families want for them to remain in their home and to remain in their communities. And that is becoming more and more of a challenge in our rural communities as the resources deplete and oftentimes families, children, are leaving those rural communities to live somewhere else. And so they're thinking about mom at home and how they keep her healthy and in her home where she wants to be. So it's important for us to have some flexibility with these particular dollars that we're requesting, to have some flexibility to really be strategic and develop some partnerships that could help us to extend those dollars and in a way that is outside of the traditional Title III funding that comes with a lot of rules and regulations that sometimes are difficult to be creative and partner with. So.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Lund. Mr. Fisk.
Yes, Chair Schumacher. A couple of quick points of why now. In 2025, we had a $526,000 reduction in our funding of senior dinings across the 14 counties, which resulted in a number of closures of sites and scaling back meals, 117,000 meals. And so that's why we have the urgency, right? Mm-hmm. Because we see this continuing to go on. And our goal with this is really we talk about piloting programs. Our goal is to be able to pilot the programs, come back to you and to the Senate to say, this is what worked, this is what didn't, mm-hmm. and how can we use these to go throughout all of Minnesota, not just in our area. Because we have a large area, we think we're well positioned to do the pilots because we have some more metro areas around St. Cloud, and then we have very rural areas in that demographic as well. So we think we're well positioned to do that pilot across there. And the other thing around senior dining, it's really one way to keep people in their homes and not in nursing homes as long as they can in their own spots. And nutrition and meals are one of the key triggers about keeping them in their homes because they have that. And so those are a couple other points that I wanted to make sure that this committee realized, well, why now? Mm-hmm. Is because we had a significant reduction and we can see coming down the road that that's likely to continue. We have to be thinking about different models because the current way is, you know, as they always say, doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result is the definition of insanity. So,
welcome to the legislature, Mr. Fisk. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1973? Seeing no one, public testimony is closed. Questions for the testifiers or the bill author? Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Representative Perryman, and for bringing this bill forward. So the question is, we funded senior meal program last session through the Minnesota Aging. Do you have access to that resources? Because that was not restricted as the Title III funds. So the question is, do you have access to those funds? Is that an option to look into?
Ms. Lund.
Yes, we are. Thank you, Representative Knorr, for that question. We are a recipient of the funding that comes through the Minnesota Board on Aging and to the Council on Aging, Central Minnesota Council on Aging in Minnesota. They are our primary funding source for our current senior nutrition model that we use. Yes.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was thinking about I think we invested a couple of $1 million. I just wanted to check with Mr. Berg if you have any information on that.
Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, no, I was looking for the amount while you were talking about that, but.
Chair Knorr. Mr. Fisk.
So, Chair Schumacher and Knorr. What I would say is our contract that we have with Central Minnesota Council on Aging is very specific in terms of where we can serve and what the model is. And so I'm not exactly sure how that funding that you gave to the Minnesota Council on Aging goes to the AAAs and to us. But what I can say is when we work with the Central Minnesota Council on Aging, they are very prescriptive in terms of what communities we serve and what the models are. So I guess that's the best answer that we have.
Mm-hmm. Chair Nor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we need to look into that because I think that the resources in that, we extended it to the next biennium. So it's still available. And we want to make sure that the seniors who need it the most, they get it. So I think we need to have that conversation with the aging and also the department.
Thank you, Chair Nor. Other questions for the testifier or the bill author? Seeing none, final word, Representative Perryman.
Chair and members, thank you for hearing HF 1973. I was thinking back where I was in 1973 when I read this, and I can't remember. So thank you for hearing it. And I'll just to the side, this is a very important bill for 14 counties. Yes, I'm selfish that I would be a lot of the counties in St. Cloud, but it will offer, and you all door knocked during the campaign, you saw senior citizens in their homes, and they all want to stay in their homes. These are programs and meals to give them social time and to stay in their homes and eat nutritionally and be able to just live still independently of nursing homes or any other government programs that they may have to go on to. So I think it's a great bill, and to Representative Nor, I'd love to help find some numbers that we can get back to you or the committee as well, because I know this organization has great oversight and they would have that information for you. Yep. So thank you very much for hearing us.
All right. With that, House File 1973 is laid over. Next on the agenda, House File 736, Representative Olson. And as he makes his way forward, I will move that House File 736 be laid over for possible inclusion. We do have an A1 amendment. I will present or move the A1 amendment. Representative Olson, welcome to the committee. The bill and amendment are before us. Whenever you're ready, please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 736 is a bill that benefits allows Blue Earth County the ability to negotiate for Welcome Manor. Welcome Manor is a wonderful treatment facility in Garden City. Had the honor of touring it last summer. And what they do there to help women who are suffering from addiction is truly phenomenal. They are they're one of a kind in that they try and accommodate women who have small children. So any child between 0 and 5 years old has the ability to stay with their mother as their mother is receiving the treatment that is needed, as well as the training that is needed for some of these women to really bond with their child and to provide that kid with the best possible outcome. So this is a wonderful facility. They desperately need this, and we want to ensure that it occurs. I've got the manager here of Welcome Manor who's able to answer any of the real technical questions, since this is not my wheelhouse.
Understood, and thank you for that. Before we move to the testimony, we'll take a vote on the A1 amendment. Are there any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Karen Clabundy, and I am the Center Director at Welcome Manor Family Services. Thank you for allowing me to testify today on House File 736. I've been the director at Welcome Manor Family Services for the past 12 years. We're a residential treatment facility located in Blue Earth County, just outside of Mankato. Since 2007, we've been providing residential short-term treatment addiction services to women and children. Last February, our previous owners decided it was time to enjoy retirement, and Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge stepped up and purchased our facility so that we could continue our critical work. Today, we are requesting a higher residential housing support rate for 20 of the beds in our facility so that we can fulfill long-term services that are desperately needed. Treatment services, housing, food, everything else, as you guys know, has been increasing each year. We want to make sure that we can ensure the best care for our women and children. While we found children can often be a driving factor for a mother to achieve and maintain sobriety, they can also be a barrier to treatment. There are very few facilities in Minnesota that are able to serve just women, and specifically women with children. I'm happy to say that Welcome Manor is one of the few that provides services to women and their children ages 5 to 0. So let me share a little bit with you about some information about Welcome Manor and who we serve. We have an on-site daycare that can accommodate up to 41 children at any given time, while we provide services to 53 of their moms. We serve approximately 150 women a year and 220 children in a year. In addition to substance use disorder, 87% of our women are admitted with a co-occurring disorder, and many more are diagnosed after they admit to us with a co-occurring disorder. Sadly, under half of our women that come into us report they are coming from a stable housing environment. Our average length of stay is about 3.5 months for our women with children and about 2 months for women that reside with us without their children. So this means as soon as a woman enters into our program, we start planning for a discharge. And one of the first steps in our discharge planning for more than half of our women is trying to find stable housing. It's a battle that we often don't win. Let me briefly share with you a recent example of why this housing support rate adjustment is so important to continuing our work. Less than a month ago, we had a client stay with us, and I'll refer to her as Lisa. Lisa was with us and ran out of funding about 30 days into her treatment. We tried for weeks to get her funding. It didn't work out. Eventually, she was discharged. We knew, and she knew, she wasn't ready. She didn't want to go, and we didn't want to let her go. But she was discharged. About a week after she was discharged, Lisa started drinking. About 2 weeks after discharge, Lisa called us and she said, I need help. I'm drinking a liter of alcohol a day. I can't stop. I'm going to drink more. I think I'm going to die. Can I come back? I could go on and tell you more about the Lisas from Welcome Manor that have left us that weren't ready. And I could tell you about the less fortunate ones that didn't make that call back to us, like Lisa, and even the ones that lost their lives to addiction. But we just don't have time for all those stories. So I will end by just asking you, please, simply think about all the Lisas in Minnesota that need help. Consider how many lives that could be saved by supporting this residential housing support rate. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify from the public on House File 736? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Member questions, Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. I want to talk about the model that you use and how incredibly valuable I think it is. Representative Olson and I serve on children and families together, and we hear a lot about the child welfare system and a lot about what that looks like. And I just want to say, anytime we can encourage development of programs that keep children with their parents while they're getting better, we are doing amazing work for those kiddos and for those families, but we're also saving ourselves a lot of money. The trauma of taking a child away from a parent so a parent can get treatment is traumatizing. Anytime we split up a family, it is traumatizing, and we should do everything in our power all the time to try to avoid it.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Any other questions or comments from members? Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is a comment both about this bill and other ones that we'll hear. I think I'm going to be a bit of a broken record here. Like, I had the opportunity to tour Welcome Manor and see that the good work that they do, and I don't think that that's at question here. I think the question that this committee is going to have to ask ourselves again is, these organizations aren't unique in the state. We need more of them. There's certainly not enough. And so we have to ask as a committee, do we want to individually fund just the programs that are able to get up here and ask for the support? Or do we want to try to have a more of a broader impact as a committee and establish some sort of grant program so like the people at Welcome Manor doing the good work that they do can continue that work, but the rest of the organizations in the state that are also doing similar work also have a chance at some additional support from us as a legislature. So again, I can't say enough good things about the work that you do, and I want to thank Representative Olson for bringing this bill forward. It's a good organization. I think it's just going to be a challenge this year for us as a committee of how we decide to where we choose to invest state dollars. So I just want us to continue to think about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for that perspective, Representative Frederick. Any other comments or questions for the bill author? Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I am interested in kind of following what Representative Hicks said about family preservation. I do think that that's key. Moorhead also has a new facility that's helping moms as they walk through this. I think sobriety is a key to a lot of really healthy living. So can you tell me a little bit about what other services you help those moms get connected to? Childcare, Medicaid, food SNAP, you know, food support, SNAP, any of those. Can you tell me kind of how that works in your organization?
Ms. Clubundy.
Mr. Chair, members, yes to all those things. We help our women connect to all those things you just listed. We have a whole community within our little building at Welcome Manor. We have on-site medical. We have on-site daycare. And we provide those mental health services, things like that, while they're with us. But a big, important part of our job is hooking them up for discharge and those aftercare plans. So, yes, we have a parenting educator. We have a whole department of what we call parenting coaches to help moms learn how to parent, also hook them into resources, be it a daycare, be it a love and logic class, things like that. We have treatment coordinators that their only role in our facility is hooking moms up to resources, financial, housing, education, jobs, you name it.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that. I mean, I think a lot of our organizations do that, kind of highlighting the bigger need that we do need to focus on, because a lot of those programs that you just mentioned, you know, are looking at massive deficits. And so we all need to make sure that the things you plug into stay, you know, supported. So one of the other things I kind of want to ask, because you're Greater Minnesota, this is like countywide, is the physical transportation of getting moms and babies to where they need to go. There's one thing of like calling and signing up for things, but getting to locations. We actually just had a conversation yesterday about non-emergency medical transportation to help people get to the services that they need that aren't like these high-level critical emergency needs. How do you transport or get these families to the physical locations that they need to go to, or do you just rely on public transit or something else that they would have to lean into?
Ms. Clubundy.
Mr. Chair, members, we rely heavily on our staff. We do use insurance rides when they are available. You must book those basically 48 hours in advance, and sometimes we don't have 48 hours in advance. When kids get sick, you have to go to urgent care. So our staff drive all the time. We hire drivers. We have transporters. Mankato is our main hub for all the services that you're talking about, and we take them. We pick them up to come into treatment. We take them to where they need to go. We'll help them get to wherever they discharge to.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you. I think that the work that you're doing is really good. I love the family preservation piece. I like that you're connected to community. As Greater Minnesota, the way that we approach our services is so different. The geographic spread, the timing, you know, a mom can work over here and then the service is 45 minutes another direction. That can be really complicated. So I'm really grateful for your work. I think I would also lean into what we've said. We're just, you know, money's tight, and that doesn't mean that we don't understand what we're doing. I think that it is critical, like I said, that we continue to fund and support those plug-in mechanisms that you're utilizing to be so successful with the women and the families that you're working with. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Seeing no other questions or comments from members, Representative Olson, final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the committee for hearing this bill. I'll leave you with kind of a little bit of what I experienced when I went in there and toured this facility. I walked in, and immediately it was impressed upon me that there is a culture of joy and healing in this facility. And on top of that, I used to be a school teacher, so I know the stories that some of these kids have to tell. And I remember going into the gym and seeing these children, and they were playing, and they were joyful, and they didn't have the concern that comes along with the experiences that they live in. And this is just one of the most wonderful programs that I have in my district, and I think it's one of the best programs that we have in the state. It's a truly wonderful opportunity for women to stay with their kids and receive the treatment that they need.
Thank you, Representative Olson. With that, House File 736, as amended, is laid over. The final piece on the agenda for today is a discussion and an update from the Department of Human Services on Waiver Reimagine. And members, a thought here today is to get an overview. There's opportunity to make adjustments and changes and hear feedback from our constituents and stakeholders throughout the state. I know there's been a lot of feedback, but we haven't had a chance to really talk about this. We don't have a bill before us on this at the moment. There is, I do have a bill that if we wanted to work on and do a DE or something in the future after today's discussion, if we get some feedback, I would be open to that. But today the purpose is to hear from the department on how things are going and then hear from stakeholders on their perspective on how things are going. So with that warm introduction, welcome to the committee. Please state your names for the record and present your update.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher and members of the committee. Elise Bailey, Budget Director for the Department of Human Services. I am here with my colleague, Colin Stemper, our Chief Administrative Officer for the Aging and Disability Services area of our department. We're pleased to be here to have this discussion on Waiver Reimagine, a really important project that the department and in partnership with the legislature it has embarked on for several years. And so with that, I'll jump right in. So we thought it would be good to kind of ground the committee on what problems we're really seeking to solve with this project. The four different disability waivers, so the CAC waiver, the BI waiver, the DD waiver, and the CADI waiver, have all grown up in the human services systems over time. So we've added things and add. And it's become a really complex system for not only us at the department to administer, but really for people to understand what's available to them, how they can choose the services that fit their needs and their goals in their lives. And it's become kind of a system that's really challenging to navigate for all parties involved. And so the goal of this project was really to kind of take a step back and look at the system as it was today, back in 2017, and think about if we were to build it today, how would we build it and what would it look like? Because as you know, we've built over time, and that's not necessarily how you would build a house if you were building on additions. If you were starting from ground zero, it would definitely look different. So back in 2017, we had these three goals, which are the same goals that we have today. One is to simplify information about the services and the process to apply for services, so that a person and their family can understand what services are available. They can describe them on their own behalf so they can advocate for themselves and then ultimately get the services that they need. We also have a goal of providing complete, accurate, and accessible information so that people can make informed decisions and choices while they're planning for services. So at the time in 2017, we had multiple waivers with different services on those waivers with different rates, some services that kind of behaved in the same manner, so it was confusing on which service to choose, and there wasn't an understanding of how much budget or how much funding a person could potentially have access to. So that leads me to like the second goal, which is a key grounding principle of Waiver Reimagine, where every person across the state, regardless of where they live, their case manager, who they're working with, or the tribal nation that they're working with, they can access services and funding equitably, and that the system wouldn't have disparities based on their disability type or their diagnosis or the knowledge that they may have or not have about the services that may be available to them. What we've seen over time is that there's a great wide discrepancy across people even within a county or tribe, let alone across the state, as far as what whether a person has high need or low need and what services that they can access at that time, because it's such a complex system and we don't have a systematic way to equitably disperse funding. And then lastly, self-direction is a key component of this program or of this project. Right now, we have a self-directed program called CDCS, or Consumer Directed Community Supports, that allows a person to, rather than do the traditional method of seeking a provider through traditional means, the person can hire their own staff and they can self-direct their own services in a way that best fits them. But a person has to opt in its entirety, and Director Stemper will go over this. They either have to opt all in or opt all out of this program. So one key goal of this project is to put information in the hands of people, put a budget so they know before that they're planning for services, and allow them to pick and choose whether they want to self-direct this service and not self-direct the other. And so that's a key component of this program that will really benefit people in the end, so that they're in charge of their lives, they can choose what services fit them, and they have all the information at their fingertips to do that. So going into the history of Wave Reimagine, this has been a long road, and in the middle of it has been a worldwide pandemic. So we've it's been a long time coming, and we have quite a long ways to go to finalize the project. So as I mentioned, in 2017, this is where we began. The legislature authorized DHS to conduct two separate studies that were combined into this one project. One was around waiver consolidation. Do we really need to have four different waivers, or could we structure it differently? And so we studied how other states set up their waivers and what would be the best solution for Minnesota. The second study was around individual budgeting. So how can we redesign the system to ensure equitable access to budgets? We submitted that study to the legislature in 2019. And in that session, the legislature then authorized us to create a common service menu. So this was phase one of Waiver Reimagine, where if we were to change the waivers, we would need to do some alignment across the different waivers around services and making sure that all the waivers have the same services, that people can access it irrespective of what waiver they were currently on. And Mr. Stemper will go over that in a bit. So in 2021, that was implemented, that phase one. At that time, we also submitted a second report to the legislature, and this was more detailed recommendations around what that phase one looked like in the waiver consolidation, as well as what a budgeting model would look like. And to kind of ground you on how we designed the budgeting model, we're talking about a system right now in fiscal year 24 of we're serving over 70,000 people, and we have spending of about $5 billion. At the time of doing the analysis, we were serving 48,000 people at a budget of about $2 billion. So we had utilized the data at that time, looking at how do we create a budget that works for people and that aligns with their needs. So we were looking at the assessment, the questions in the assessment at that time, and define different budgets based on where a person lives and what their age is, and then along with multiple items in the assessment around what their general support needs are, what their physical support needs are, and what their psychosocial needs are. So creating different ranges of budgets depending on a person's need, what their age is, and where they live. That aligned with the rates and the services at the time. So at that time, the legislature authorized DHS to implement this phase two, which is, they authorized us to implement these budgets. We also established that year, or in 2022, the Waiver Reimagine Advisory Committee, where we're working with community members on the rollout and the implementation of Waiver Reimagine as required by the legislature. Mr. Stemper will go into a lot of the community engagement we've done, but we, throughout from 2017 up to this point, we've had, multiple different types of community engagement around this project. But this is a key formal group that we've been working with. Throughout this time, another key factor is the assessment. So MinChoices is the assessment that defines whether a person is eligible for the waivers. And there's multiple questions in the assessment. And we've been working with counties and tribes on
that assessment, because it's been a challenge for the local agencies to administer this assessment because there's a lot of questions and it's really time consuming. So we've been working with them over these years on how to make that tool, the technical tool, work better for them as well as work better for people. And so we've made several adjustments to MnChoices, and we've rolled out, you know, a new kind of reformed MnChoices this fall. What's key to that is that our budget will be based on that assessment. And so it's really important for us to have key data, important data, reliable data to have the final budget set on. And so, as I said, you know, in 2017, we served 48,000 people. That's how we defined the budget, or kind of drafted the draft budget around. And by 2029, we will serve 95,000 people at $9 billion. And so it's really key for us to pull this new data in the new MnChoices assessment and realign what the budget structure will look like based on the current needs of the current population, as well as the new reformed questions in MnChoices. So making sure that it's a data-based and reliable way to set budgets. Because of that, we have delayed the implementation of Waiver Reimagine to January 1st, 2027. And Mr. Stemper will go over kind of the steps between now and then to get to that point. So as I mentioned, there's two phases, one that we have completed. So phase one was simply taking the current waiver structure and making sure that they have each waiver has a common service menu across all four. And that has been completed. And that was just the gist of phase one. But phase two is a more comprehensive approach. So we're looking at taking those four waivers and making them into two waivers where it's not based on a person's diagnosis, but rather it's based on where a person lives and kind of pulling the complexity out of the system and putting it into the back room at DHS so people don't have to navigate a complex web of challenges. In this phase, of course, as I mentioned, we're also developing and going to roll out a known and transparent budget that will be based on a person's needs and that they will have in front of them prior to working with the county or the tribe on what services they want to have in the following year. And then lastly, informed decision making and increased flexibility to self-direct. So rather than having a person have to opt in completely to a self-direction model, they'll be able to take that budget and say, I want to have this service via self-direction, but I want to have this other service via the traditional means. They'll also be able to access information online about their budget, the services that are available to them, so that they can make informed decisions and really be in the driver's seat rather than the state or the county or other people that, they aren't them. They aren't driving their own lives. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Stemper to go over more detail on these phases.
CEO Stemper, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your findings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Colin Stemper. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the Aging and Disability Services Administration at DHS. So I'll provide a little bit more information in detail that Director Bailey covered. The first phase of Waiver Reimagine was establishing a common service menu, and regardless of the next steps in this work, this was a needed change to our waiver services. So prior to this change, depending what waiver a person received, services that provided similar supports had different names, different payment rates, different billing codes. And especially for people who were navigating these programs, providers who were serving people on multiple different waivers, case managers trying to make sense of these different programs, it was very difficult to navigate these different names and codes. So what phase one did was simplify and streamline the service name. So if a service provided similar supports across the different programs, it now had the same name. For providers, you would have a single billing code for the same service across all the same programs, and the payment rates were consistent regardless of which program a person was receiving. This was implementation that was completed throughout 2021, so that's the environment we're living in right now. We also know that oftentimes, though there's often a lot of changes that are happening with these programs, so it's important to know what phase one was and the rather limited changes that were made to that program back in 2021. So with phase two, like Director Bailey mentioned, is focused on consolidation of the waiver programs, establishment and rollout of individual budgets, and building more opportunities for informed choice for people and families receiving services through these programs. First would be consolidating the four current diagnosis-based waivers to two waivers based on where a person lives. Then implementing individual budgets based on a person's assessed needs, typical costs of their services, and that would replace the current lead agency-based approach to budgeting. So in the current environment and for the last over 20 years, the way we control costs on these waiver programs is we provide budgets to lead agencies or counties and tribal nations, which they have to manage the cost of everyone served on their programs within that amount. That can be rather straightforward if you're serving several thousand people at your county. It can be a lot more challenging if you're serving less than 30 people in your smaller county or your tribe. So that's one of the challenges that we're seeking to resolve with phase two. Another change with phase two will be that people will have access to their personal information, like their budget, the services that they use to make more informed decisions about their life and their supports. And we continue to work with the Waiver Reimagined Advisory Committee on this implementation. So we wanted to walk through a few things that will be different with Waiver Reimagined compared to the current state. And the first is the access to funding that people have. So now, like I was mentioning, a person's funding is based on their county or tribe that serves them. The ability for the person, their family, to advocate for themselves and knowledge of complex waivers. When we were doing stakeholder engagement at the very beginning of this project, one consistent thing we heard, and I imagine something that all of you have heard as well, is that there's just so much information that people need to know about these programs. And like Director Bailey said, one of the goals of this initiative is to take away the amount of knowledge people feel like they need to know about this system and just be able to describe the needs that they have instead of being knowledgeable about DHS's manuals, for instance. One thing that can also drive funding at the moment is the knowledge of the person's case manager. We know there's a lot of turnover currently in these positions, and that can really impact the person's supports year over year or a person trying to get supports for the first time. Right now, the methodology that determines funding for people and lead agencies is over 20 years old. We know that it needs to be updated, and we see this initiative as the method of updating this methodology. Right now as well, a person's responses on their assessment to specific questions can change their budget year over year. So if you answer one question differently in 2025 than you did in 2024, that can mean a very different budget for you this year, and that can be very frustrating in terms of continuing a person's supports year over year. So with Waiver Reimagined, we change how a person's funding is determined. So it's determined by a person's assessed needs regardless of their geography. So if they're served in Minneapolis, if they're served in Fargo, Duluth, Grand Rapids, it's going to be the same amount of funding regardless of where they live within the state. The funding is also determined by the typical cost of services and current assessment data. And in difference to the current budget methodology, responses, or your budget is based on responses to a number of questions. So if you change your answer to one of the assessment questions, it's not necessarily going to mean you're going to get a different budget methodology than you received the previous year. One thing we've heard in terms of the budget methodology is concern about the difference in budgets for people receiving residential services versus people who are receiving services in their own home. And why I bring that up is the budget methodology that we've proposed is reflecting the cost, the typical cost of services today. So many of the rates that we have for these programs are based in law, and the budgets are reflective of those payment rates in law. Typically, residential rates, so group home rates, for instance, are higher than rates for people who receive services in their own home. And the reason for that is it's typically paying for quite a few more staff members than people receiving services in their own home. So the budgets are just mainly reflective of rates under current law. Hypothetically, if the legislature updated rates to be equal between those two settings, the budgets would become roughly equal as well. So to ensure service continuity, we made sure the budgets are aligned with the current rates that we have under law. They'll also be updated as we near implementation to reflect changes that have been made to rates since the last time the budgets were calculated. Another improvement is to self-direction. So now when a person self-directs their own services, like Director Bailey noted, they have to either self-direct all of their services or none of their services. It's kind of a zero-sum decision. A person can't self-direct any of their services right now if they receive residential services, so that limits a person's choice as well. And like I mentioned, the methodology that's used to set individual budgets for people who self-direct their own services is over 20 years old at this point. So under waiver reimagine, people have a lot more options to self-direct their services. They can self-direct one, some, or all of their services, or none if they would prefer to. A person can continue to receive residential services and self-direct their other services as well. And a big change is that a person will receive the same budget regardless of whether or not they choose to self-direct their services or not. So that creates a bit more equity and doesn't penalize people who decide to self-direct their services. So another improvement is just putting more power into people's hands who receive services and driving what's important to them. So now being able to self-advocate can be a bit challenging because people really are reliant on the information they receive from their case manager. The case manager holds a lot of the information about a person's services, and a person has to receive that information from their case manager. Like I was mentioning, a person has to navigate information about waiver services that may not apply to them. Based on if you're receiving services in your own home or a provider-controlled residential setting, you may not have access to some services that appear to be on the service menu. So it can be confusing about which services a person can receive and which they can't at the moment. Oftentimes, a person's budget is unknown to them prior to service planning as well. So like I mentioned, for many of the people who receive waiver services, the county or tribal nation is balancing their costs against everyone else they're serving within their lead agency budget. So in the back of the case manager's mind, they may know, for this person, I have a budget of X number of dollars that may or may not be shared with the person. So it's, again, it's another point where the person is really reliant on the case manager, and the case manager holds a lot of power over that person's support decisions. Under Waiver Reimagined, we're trying to put more power and control in the people's and families' hands so that they are kind of equal partners with case managers in determining their supports. Like I mentioned, we're in the process of developing a web-based portal where the person will be able to access their information about their services, their budgets, just being more knowledgeable about their services so that they can bring that information to meetings with their case manager and be equal partners in the planning process. The person will receive service options based on the waiver you receive. So when you look at the service menu today and what the service menu would be under the new waiver programs, it does look like options are disappearing based on which waiver you'll be served on. But with the new waiver menu, it's more reflective of current policy about what services a person can receive based on their residential setting. So again, taking some of that complexity and putting it into the back where people don't necessarily need to know, you'll see the services that you are eligible for under the new menus. And of course, a person will know their budget prior to service planning with the individual budget methodology replacing the process where case managers have more information than the people oftentimes currently. Like Director Bailey mentioned, a lot of this work has been informed by community engagement, and that's a value that we'll continue to have going forward. We want to focus bring in the voices of people and families in these changes. There have been multiple and ongoing outreach efforts since 2018 when this work started, including focus groups, surveys, community meetings, and individual conversations with people who currently receive these services. The Waiver Reimagined Advisory Committee was established in 2021 and continues to meet today. We've also sought specific feedback from tribal nation partners through a meeting series with those entities as well. We also recognize the need to improve community engagement strategies and have engaged in individualized outreach to understand perspectives from racially diverse communities as well. So also, like Director Bailey mentioned, there's still quite a lot of work to go before we can launch the Waiver Reimagined Phase 2 changes. So in the coming months, we'll be collecting new assessment data to recalibrate budgets. Like Director Bailey mentioned, there was a change in the assessments that's been rolling out over the past few years, and now that it is fully phased in, we can begin collecting assessment data to base the new budgets on. We are going to engage with the community to gather requirements about the web-based portal I was mentioning so that it's a piece of technology that people are interested and eager to use. We have to update some existing legacy systems to support implementation of these new waivers, and we'll continue consulting with the Waiver Reimagined Advisory Committee along the way. On this schedule, we plan to begin outreach to people and families about recalibrated budgets in mid-2026 prior to implementation. Our next slide just includes a few links for your own viewing around the two legislative reports that have been issued along the way, as well as the website for the Waiver Reimagined Initiative generally, as well as the Waiver Reimagined Advisory Committee. And that brings us to the end of our presentation. We really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Semper, Director Bailey, for the presentation here. What I'd like to do, if there's technical questions from the presentation or just clarifying, I'd like to take those questions now, then take the public testimony, then have these two come back to have whatever remaining time for a more broader discussion with the feedback from stakeholders. Representative Hicks.
Thank you both for this presentation. I have a question about nursing and the budgets. So currently under CDCS and under the traditional waiver plan, you know, can you help us understand how nursing is currently funded in those plans and what we would be looking at in Waiver Reimagine, and if we need to make any changes in that space, or if we have the ability to make any change? I guess the question, not if, I don't want your opinion. Do we have the ability to make any changes in that space? Around nursing, particularly for folks that have high-level needs like trachs and things like that.
Okay. Sure. Mr. Temper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hicks. So under the current system, it really depends on how a person receives nursing. If If they self-direct their services, those supports may be included in their budget. If they don't self-direct those services, they may just be authorized as part of their support plan. Under current law, with Waive Reimagine, this can get complicated. Nursing, there's concepts of in the budget and out of the budget services. So out of the budget services mean that a person can be authorized for those services and they don't count against the budget. And so nursing is one of those services that's out of the budget. And the reason that we made that decision was we didn't want a person seemingly making choices between their medical needs and perhaps services they enjoy receiving. And so the decision was to keep it out of the budget, make sure the person can get their nursing supports as they need to, and continue planning the rest of their services without an impact to those nursing supports. We understand from feedback we've received from the community that that can have some unintended consequences for self-directing those nursing services as well. So there are changes that could be made to law to change the current implementation plan, and the department would be opening to working with the legislature to make those changes if interested.
Representative Hicks.
So when you say that we could make changes, we could make changes so that that would be an option that we could talk about. Would we need to make any changes to the min choices in that space, or do you think we could do that just through Waiver Reimagine? I just want to kind of know which areas we'd have to be discussing.
Mr. Stemper.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, that's a good question. This would be primarily Waiver Reimagine changes. We don't anticipate it would require min choices changes.
Representative Hicks. Any other clarifying questions before public testimony? Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to understand the budget following the individual, whether they're in a residential setting or in their own home. Does that really change depending on the service where they're receiving the services?
Mr. Stemper.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, yes, the budget would be different for a person who was served in a group home versus their own home. And that's really reflective of the typical costs that we see for people in both of these settings. So in our most recently completed fiscal year, for instance, for a person on the DD waiver, when a person is served in their own home, their typical cost per day are a little around $200 per day. And if they're served in a group home, the costs are over $400 a day. So if we're setting up budgets and want to ensure service continuity, we need to make sure those budgets are different depending on where a person resides.
Chair Knorr.
And so, thank you, Mr. Chair. So when it's self-directed, the same components will remain the same for the self-directed programs. Is that correct?
Mr. Stemper.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, yes. If a person self-directs or if they don't self-direct, it will be the same budget regardless.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think there's a lot of fear and concern about this process. So I'm grateful to hear when you went through your presentation talking about community meetings, focus groups, surveys, and individual conversations. Can you say more about those? Because all of that's good, but details also matter. Because if it's a community meeting in St. Paul and a community meeting in Minneapolis, and that's it, then I would say that's not enough. So I would just like to know more about what that looked like.
Mr. Stemper.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frederick, yes, one of the things that we wanted to make sure with this process was we weren't just collecting voices from the metro area, that we were collecting from all across the state. So at the very beginning of the project, we did in-person meetings in several greater Minnesota locations. We also found that those weren't always super well attended. Obviously, if it takes time for people to go to a community meeting and actually attend that. And of course, then pretty shortly afterwards, we also had the pandemic. So we moved much of this engagement online as well. So that's been a big focal point for collecting feedback and having these conversations in the years since is having electronic means of collecting feedback from people across the state as well.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this ongoing still? Like, is this still happening? Are you still planning on continuing these efforts to communicate with people?
Mr. Semper.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frederick, yes. So we still have the Waive Reimagined Advisory Committee, whose meetings are broadcast on YouTube as well, and we plan to continue community engagement and outreach up until implementation and ongoing afterwards.
Representative Frederick. All right, we have about 35 minutes left. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. Who's on the advisory committee? Who makes it up? Is there the employees? Are they people from within different organizations? Who makes it up?
Mr. Stemper.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's primarily people who receive services and their family members. We do have limited representation from counties, tribes, and service providers, but it's primarily people with disabilities and their families.
Representative Murphy.
Chair, go in the back of Representative Frederick's question, where are those typically held then? I know some are by Zoom, but are they rural areas that they're drawn from? Are they metro areas? Can you give us some idea what the history has been since 2017, where that's come from?
Mr. Stemper.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the meetings of the Waive Reimagined Advisory Committee have always been electronic and remote. So they aren't held in person. They began during the pandemic, so they've always been remote and have continued that way. When we are looking at members, we also want to make sure that we're getting representation from people across the state as well, because we understand that service delivery in particular is going to look a lot different across the state. We want to incorporate those perspectives as well.
Representative Murphy.
One last question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you incorporate the county's feedback in choosing those people? Do you reach out to different counties? And what counties have you worked with primarily?
Mr. Stemper.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we haven't gone to counties to solicit membership for the Waive Reimagined Advisory Committee. It's primarily been an open call for membership published on DHS communication channels. Appointments are made through the Secretary of State's office as well. So we haven't typically worked with our counties to identify members of the committees. We have been engaging with the counties generally on these changes as well. There's limited membership on the committee itself. We also have conversations with all counties in Minnesota outside of that advisory committee as well.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just an invitation to the counties, I think it'd be a very a good thing to do. I think they'd want to be involved in some of this too. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you're on the right track by consolidating these things. You know, if you have a waiver system that was built over a very long time, very piecemeal, maybe doesn't really provide cohesive kind of good blanket coverage, you might have some little gaps. It does seem very strange that a person's familiarity with a weird program would dictate the degree of coverage that they would get under that program. So I think all of this sounds really good. I'm new to this whole arena, but I'm a little bit confused over the word waiver. To me, the word waiver should imply that they're operating under some sort of exception, operating under some sort of unique circumstance that's very unusual. And yet, we use the word waiver to mean coverage for a ton of folks in this place. So would you please kind of, I mean, maybe it happens nationwide like this, but can we do better than waiver? Can the base coverage be appropriate so we don't need so many waivers? So that's my first question.
Mr. Stemper.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gander. Yeah, it's an odd phrasing that kind of reflects the decades-old nature of these programs. So what the state is waiving when we implement these programs is support in institutional settings, like intermediate care facilities for people with developmental disabilities, hospitals, nursing homes, and essentially providing an alternative to those settings in a community-based environment. So under Medicaid nationally, those programs are the services that people are entitled to. So you have an entitlement to care in a nursing facility. So we are essentially waiving those entitlements and making care available in the community as a replacement. So that's kind of the behind the scenes on that phrasing.
Interesting. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then my last question, I don't think I heard it in your presentation. Suppose we're successful with this. Do you have a really ironclad transition plan so that as they go from this group of waivers to this more concise group of waivers that there's no gap in coverage, no lapse, no, crud, this ended last month and this one doesn't start for 2 months. Do you have a really solid plan to bridge between those two?
Mr. Stemper.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gander, this is going to be a rolling implementation. So throughout 2027. So some people will experience some changes beginning in January of that year. Some people will experience changes beginning in December of that year. And one of our goals, primarily through the web-based portal, is to get information out to people before that transition to occur, so they can begin to plan some of the changes to their services that they may be anticipating. For a lot of people, it's going to be having a budget for the first time and understanding the responsibilities that come with that, as well as some of the challenges. So we want to make sure we are getting that information out to people as soon as we can, as soon as it's available to us and them, as well as the counties and tribal nations that will be supporting people through this program. We realize that the case managers will be an integral part of this transition, and so we want to make sure they're prepared as well.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all.
Okay. We have about a half an hour left in here, and we have five people who have signed up to testify. If Kathy Jo Ware can start making her way up. What I would like to do is have the public testimony last for about 20 minutes, so about 4 minutes apiece on those, and then bring the department back up to help with any questions that may have come up from the testimony. There's also written testimony that's in our packets. There's even more written testimony that's on the committee website. So with that, welcome to the committee.
Thank
you. If you're ready, please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Chair Schumacher, committee members, thank you for letting me testify today. My name is Kathy Ware. This is my son, Kylan Ware. Kylan is 30 years old. If I listed out every disability that he had, we would be here for the full 20 minutes. So just suffice it to say that he's got significant disabilities, okay? Again, he lives at home with me. I'm a registered nurse, been a registered nurse for over 25 years. I'm also a MnChoices assessor for a lead agency, and I've been a case manager, and I've been doing that for, it'll be 18 years in June, all good reviews. So there's that. So I know the system on the inside and the outside, okay? Kylan requires 24-hour care. He gets his care right now on a CAC waiver, okay? Right now, we self-direct. Representative Hicks, so that was a superb question because that's what I've been trying to get across. I have emailed with Colin, I've emailed with Elise, I've emailed with Natasha Mers, Heidi Hamilton. I've been emailing the Department of Human Services for 5 or 6 years about Waiver Reimagine. You want to talk about saving tax dollars? Keeping Kylan Ware home in my house with me saves Minnesota taxpayers about $600,000 every single year. So if you want to save taxpayer money, you will assure that we get the assistance that we need to keep Kylan at home with me. Waiver Reimagine doesn't do that. So if you implement Waiver Reimagine, Colin, as it is right now, Kylan will not be able to live at home with me. And I have told DHS this for 5 years, no one is listening. So WARAC, no one is listening. they are basing budgets also on current use and not what people are authorized to use. They have not come out with anything. And their presentation was great and fluffy and wonderful. These are the last budget ranges that they've put out in 2021. Again, I've asked for 5 or 6 years, what are the budget ranges? What will I have to support my son at home for his care needs? He is complex. He has seizures. He's got everything. We have to be on the ready to take care of him. I would like to know those self-directed budgets, and then we're basing it on a Min Choices tool that DHS knows has flaws and things like that. 2021, I testified and created this little picture for you guys. I don't want Kylan taken out of my home. I don't think you guys want him taken out of my home. We have a bill to try to get DHS to hear us. It's House File 2038, and we would like to have that passed so that we can create a task force on Waiver Reimagine to try to get DHS to actually hear us. I don't know what else to do, representatives. And they had a long time for presentation, and so we're going to have some testifiers as well. And if they come up for a rebuttal, I would like to come up with them as well, because I've been working on this as long as they have, I would imagine, and unpaid. So I would just close with this. I could talk to you guys forever. Other people want to testify. Keep Kylan at home with me. Keep his profoundly disabled peers at home with me, where he has an inclusive life that is consistent with the ADA integration mandate, which is our law, and that is consistent with the Minnesota Olmstead Plan. Okay? That's all I want. And it'll save you guys money, and it'll provide him with wonderful, awesome care in the community where he goes to dances and he goes to the Historical Society and does wonderful things with his staff. And I will email you guys. I will take questions. You can come to my house, sit down, have a cup of coffee with me, anything. I will do anything to get people to hear me about my son. I love him. I want him at home with me until God takes me off the planet. Thank you, Senator Schumacher. Thank you, representatives.
Thank you, Ms. Ware, for your testimony today. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Tricia Brisbane on Zoom. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony. And you are muted. If you could please unmute yourself and restate your introduction. We can hear you now.
Okay, thank you. My name's Tricia Brisbane, and this is my son, Charlie Brisbane. Chair Schumacher and members of the committee, so sorry not to be there in person with you today. The nature of our lives makes it difficult sometimes to do simple things like leave our home and come to public places. However, I'm very appreciative for your time. I'm a parent of a child with disabilities who has a primary diagnosis of global developmental delays, and I am a member of the RAC. I've worked with, and that is the Waiver Reimagine Advisory Committee. Sorry, we get used to those acronyms. I've worked with children and youth with disabilities and their families for over 14 years, helping them navigate these complex systems of care, including Medicaid waivers. Home and community-based service waivers were designed to keep individuals with disabilities in their homes and communities. These waivers have been the catalyst for deinstitutionalization. If we proceed with Waiver Reimagine as proposed, Minnesota will lead a new path as a state to reinstitutionalize its citizens with disabilities. We have overwhelming data that shows us it costs more to live in congregate care settings than in their own homes. Minnesotans like Charlie deserve to live a life of choice in their homes and in their community. The way that DHS has proposed changes to the waivers has been and continues to be a one-sided process. Excuse me. The explanation provided by Ms. Bailey sounds wonderful, but stakeholders and the Waiver Reimagine Advisory Committee have been telling DHS that their proposed plan will not look like they're saying it will. For example, Mr. Stumpfel stated that congregate care costs are, it costs more because they are paying for more staff. However, direct care workers in those facilities are not seeing that money in their wages and their benefits. And the care that people are receiving in those facilities is substandard to the care they would receive in their homes. Mr. Stumpfel also referred to creating a system that allows persons with disabilities to equally partner with their county case managers. Here's my question. How is DHS going to create that when they can't even meaningfully partner with members of the Waiver Reimagine Advisory Committee? The disability community along, the disability community and the RAC have been begging DHS to stop generating policies and programs for us, but rather with us for quite some time. We have mounds of data and research that tells us collaboration with stakeholders at the systems level saves money and greatly benefits outcomes for stakeholders. I personally had conversations with DHF staff individually, and I've offered in RAC meetings to help DHS understand how to use a collaborative process in community engagement specific to Waiver Reimagine. Best practices exist for this type of collaboration. In fact, I've provided specific resources to DHS regarding these best practices multiple times. I've tried to explain that a text box on a meeting feedback form is not considered driving a meaningful agenda. DHS should want this authentic partnership, and clearly they do not. I think all of you would be very concerned at how RAC members have been treated in these RAC meetings, being met with condescension and belittling. It's been made extremely clear that we are a checkbox and we are not considered to have any meaningful expertise regarding this matter. We've demanded that DHS partner with stakeholders and their families to make crucial decisions regarding Waiver Reimagine, and they have refused. We're asking you to help us hold DHS accountable by taking consideration of our bill HF2038. Last year, DHS received strong encouragement in the March Senate committee meeting. It feels like they walked off laughing. Here we are again with no significant changes, and all of the RAC members can attest to this. My friends and colleagues are going to give expert testimony today about how important waivers are to us and how much we appreciate living in a state that has treated our citizens with disabilities with dignity by supporting these waivers. You will hear specifics about the importance of these waivers and the related services. Historically, conditions in institutions and facilities lacked proper care or education. They were wrought with segregation and isolation, and these institutions were overcrowded, underfunded, and poorly maintained. And now we have a staffing shortage. Can you imagine going back to this, or even worse? Can you imagine sending your vulnerable adult family member or your child to a facility? I can't and I won't. Medicaid waivers in Minnesota are not perfect, but we need to keep moving forward. Waiver Reimagine must be reworked to prevent forced institutionalization and ensure equity, independence, and dignity for people with disabilities. For Charlie, I respectfully ask that you hear House Floor 2038 in this committee. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Brisbane, for your testimony today, and thank you, Charlie, for joining us as well. Next, we have Katrin Bachmeier. And then followed with Jean Bender. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, committee members. My name is Katrin Bachmeier, Reverend Katrin Bachmeier. And I am an administrator of Minnesota's largest support groups, and that includes the MnChoices Assessment Support Group. I have the opportunity of hearing from virtually thousands of participants on a daily basis and their families. I first want to start by, we heard about an entitlement to nursing facility institutional level of care. I want to make it clear that under the Olmstead implementation mandate, we also have an entitlement to home and community-based services to remain in the home. So that's a federal requirement. In March of 2024, DHS testified before the legislature promising to address budget reductions caused by MnChoice's assessment tool. 1 year later, families are still reporting devastating cuts and DHS has not acted. And this failure is why we really need to get 2038 going. The RAC committee was in fact compelled by the legislators at the Waiver Reimagine hearing in 2024. It is not just to collect more data. It was because at that hearing, it was determined that there are red flags all over these plans as they are proposed. Evidence submitted into testimony today, which I encourage you to read, including a submission that I entered into SF-2215, shows the connection between MnChoice's Waiver Reimagine and the CDCS unbundling changes. These are not separate initiatives. They are all part of the same restructuring effort. The MnChoice's assessment is a highly unstable assessment tool. There is discrimination built into the assessment. It's substantial, it's horrendous, and I can speak more on that later. But in general, despite DHS's claims, budget reductions continue. Out of about 30 budget determinations, we're seeing 29 cuts and maybe one increase. DHS has made CAC hospital level of care waivers more restrictive than federal standards, and this is blocking access to waiver participants who would otherwise qualify, leaving many without their life-sustaining supports. And these are all the participants who are currently in the hospital on ventilators, fighting for their lives simply because they cannot access their nursing services at home. Waiver denials are forcing participants into hospitals instead of receiving their care at home, and this dramatically increases taxpayer costs. Institutionalization costs taxpayers 67% more than home and community-based services. Other states that have restructured their waivers have exceeded cost projections by over 40%. Minnesota's on the same path without proper oversight. DHS claims that restrictions are CMS rules. If CMS policies are legally required if they restrict and place participants at high risk for institutionalization, then DHS is legally required to request variances in order to meet Olmstead mandates. We want receipts. We want to see DHS's communications. We want to see their approach. Are they simply asking CMS for permission to restrict services? We need oversight. We need transparency from DHS. We are asking that you require DHS to communicate with CMS to show those communications and justify their policy restrictions. We need to protect against further budget reductions that are leading to unnecessary hospitalizations and deaths. And as a faith leader, I am called to advocate for justice, compassion, and integrity, and how we serve our most vulnerable participants. Minnesota must do better. It is our moral and fiscal responsibility to ensure that every person has access to the care they need and that our policies reflect both accountability and humanity. I urge you to support 2038. We really need to take a step back. This pause was not just to collect more data. We have major problems with these plans as proposed. This is not just a matter of policy, but a commitment to doing what is right. Thank you for your time and your dedication to this important work.
Thank you, Reverend Bachmeyer. Next, we have Jean Bender, and we'll conclude with Nate Olson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
My name is Jean Bender. Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify today. In the past few years, our families had many conversations about the future for David, our 38-year-old family member with multiple physical, intellectual, and health disabilities. In fact, he's too ill to be here today with me. He is one of three adult children, but he's always needed significantly more support and family resources than his siblings, We've always planned to ensure that David has the supports he needs so his siblings can accept a guardianship role in their brother's life without totally disrupting their own lives and families. But with current waiver reimagined budget plans, that won't happen because he'll receive significantly fewer support dollars because he lives at home. David's dad has terminal cancer. As we redid our wills and David's guardianship documents, David's sister, who is a nurse, is so scared of the future as David's guardian, she made the heartbreaking request to be removed from any legal responsibility for her brother. David's brother lives out of state and is terrified of handling everything when I can no longer continue. In David's early 20s, we bought a duplex so he could move to his own home while we lived upstairs and could be actively involved in his transition, provide unpaid caregiving, and ensure that he has the necessary services to transition to independent living with supports. Our son has a CAC waiver, which is a hospital level of care, and uses consumer-directed community supports with a budget that is a fraction of the cost of the 24-hour care he would require in a traditional facility. We'd always believed if we provided everything we could while we were healthy and able, we could rely on formal residential services in my son's duplex when we were not able to provide the majority of his supports. But under the current proposal to assign money based on where someone lives, what provider would serve him at home when they could get four or more times the funding in a facility that they owned? Our parent group is one of the first to forego group homes in favor of truly person-centered living. Our situations are hard-fought struggles with a service system not designed to support individuals, no matter how much we say we're person-centered. Each person and family has figured out how to cobble together the supports needed through personal sacrifices, individual research, and a focus on the strengths and human dignity of our disabled adult. And we are the privileged, mostly white, middle-class, highly educated, English-speaking, American-born. We have private insurance that's the first payer of medical expenses. If we fail, other families can't or won't even try. They'll focus their efforts on supporting transitions to more expensive provider-owned residences. We've communicated our concerns to DHS and whoever will listen. We have been told, and this is a quote, our family members are outliers, and maybe there will be an exceptions process. Don't allow my son and his peers who have the most intense care needs be a waiver reimagined afterthought. Use our experiences to improve the system without yanking our family members' safety nets. Most of us would be more than willing to work with DHS to crosswalk services, entertain home visits, discussions. We're here. Our adult children are getting the supports they need in the best individual settings, and we are saving the system hundreds of thousands of dollars each person each year. I have one more quick comment, which is just this week in the Senate, a bill was heard to make exceptions to the min choice processes for individuals with intellectual disabilities and diabetes. You at the legislature don't want all of us coming with our exceptions and our diagnoses and having to write law for every single diagnosis that could mean that someone needs more help. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bender, for your testimony.
Senators, House of Representatives.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Nathaniel M. Olson, a disability advocate for the state of Minnesota. Somebody who has sat in the committees before and listened to the idea of the Department of Human Services. Where on earth is the help? I'm going to give you an example where on earth is the help because I'm standing here today. Scott County, the Department of Human Services, has a guardian who sat there and decided to lie to hospital workers to take me away from my family and friends to send me to a mental hospital. Thank goodness I had people helping me to fight. We have the Department of Human Services sitting here that are going to be funding stuff that are here. They're saying stuff. We have a governor who's trying to cut disability services. There's 628,000 people. We have lot of people speaking up against this, and the Department of Human Services has the willing to stand here and do this, we're not getting the help that we need. We're not. And sadly, I'm wondering what's going to happen to the state of Minnesota. So I ask you, start helping, because those people need the help. And I'm going to keep fighting and fighting, and you're going to hear more from me, because I am not giving up on the disability people in the state of Minnesota. Governor Walz's plan to cut disability services is not going to help. Where is the money going to go to? And where are we going to fund? MN Choice has spoken. I've been waiting for my services to get renewed for almost 3.5 months. They're taking a while. And it's now time for us to step up and put a stop to this corruption. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson, for your testimony. That ends the list of people who signed up for public testimony. Is there anyone else who didn't make the list who would like, okay, please make your way forward? And if you could please confine your remarks to about 2 minutes.
Just 2 minutes of your time, please.
Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
My name is Linda G, and then my son, Michael G, has been in your building. The thing I wanted to bring up was this idea about the common menu of services, that everybody had to have a common menu of services. Now, when it comes to people with developmental disabilities, they have always had the service called day training and rehabilitation services. And so you had goals and objectives at your meetings where they would work on things and say, two-step process. Can you follow a two-step process? And then there was like a way that they were keeping track of it. My son goes to a day program, and they were keeping track of Michael's development as a person to become more mature. Now, under the Waiver Reimagine program, they deleted day training and rehabilitation services, and they have replaced it with day support services. Now, with day support services, it's just activities, and it's like social activities. So in my opinion, they turned it into something more like adult daycare for a person over 65 years old. And they took out all the rehabilitation that people with a low IQ needs. My son's IQ is like 43, okay? It's not over 70, it's like 43. You know, for him to learn how to tie his shoes, it was like an aide helping him over and over and over again to learn how to tie shoes, his shoelaces. If he never got that help, he never would have learned how to tie shoelaces. And so I actually want my son to grow up. I want him to become more independent. But with this way that they're saying day support services, no day training and rehabilitation services, it's like they're dumbing things down to do this common menu of services. They're dumbing things down now, so there's no longer any metrics. They took away all the metrics of how much progress you're making. So now they just throw you in there as a day program to just say, play, go color. You can color now. You can go on a little trip to the zoo. So they made it into like coloring and stuff like that for people with sub 70 IQs. And so when they say common support services, common menu of services, they have dumbed it down. It's the same thing with the autism programs. When they created the autism programs, there are no, they just let these providers become autism providers, no credentials. And so we know as parents that this the same people is the transition provider, and they're the autism provider. They don't care. They don't care if somebody wears both hats, even though the person that's a transportation provider knows nothing about autism, they still allow them to be called the transition provider. So that's one of the things about what DHS is doing now, is they are completely dumbing down things so an autism provider can be your transportation provider. And I just think you have to know that, that how much they've dumbed it down to do this common menu of services.
Thank you for that. And to complete the public testimony today, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Schirmacher. My name is Alice Hulbert, and I have a 40-year-old son who lives home with me and my husband, and we have some staff who help one other young woman who's been fabulous and worked with him for 7 years. So that's been really nice. He originally got a waiver in 2010. Back in that time, there were waiting lists, and there was a moratorium on group homes, and we were told the best thing to do is to buy a house and have it as an unlicensed group home and work with a provider. So that's what we did. We bought a house in Bloomington. We got a provider. We found other people. So we had an unlicensed group home. So he was there for 4 years, and then the provider walked out because he was too difficult to look after. Then we had another provider. He lived in a condominium by himself, and they stayed with him for 3 years, and then they left because he was too difficult to take care of. The thing is that the waiver has been constantly evolving. So in 2016, they got rid of the waiting list. In 2020, they changed the definition of needing a nursing home level of care to qualify to cover a lot more people. And that's been efficient for getting services for people who need services. But that's part of the explanation for why the costs have gone up exponentially and the number of people served continues to go up. So as they've tried to save money and simplify and create Waiver Reimagined, the merging of the waivers is starting to blur why people are on waivers and make it difficult to control costs. I think it's just getting worse and worse. It's not simpler. We can't even hire one staff to give my son a shower and give him his medicine because only PCAs can give a shower, but they're not allowed to give medications. That's just one example of a duplication that's just making a mess. It feels like the DHS is not listening. You notice there are no providers here to testify because they listen to the providers, and the providers have been taken in the back room and given whatever they want to go forward. When my son was with a provider, he was getting $750 a day. The provider was getting that much to take care of him. And that wasn't enough for them to keep staffing him because he was too difficult. So I don't believe this story that they need to have more money because they have more people. Thank you. They have less staff per person and vastly more money. So the way that this Waiver Reimagined has been created to give priority to institutional care and give them double the waiver amounts for people who are doing the same job at home is severely inequitable. And it's really systemic ableism. They're assuming if you live in your own home, you don't need services, therefore we're not giving you any money. My prediction is with Waiver Reimagined, when the financial part comes in, there will be a tsunami of people who've been living at home and can't live there anymore because their waivers have been cut so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Harper, for your testimony today. That concludes the amount of time we have for today. And so we didn't get a chance to have the department come back, but this is a conversation that we'll continue to have throughout the remainder of what time we have left in session. And with that, we'll see you all tomorrow morning, March 20th, 2025, 8:15. Yeah, let's do 8:15. We're adjourned.